Welcome to the deep dive. So you've sent us a whole bunch of sources, all focusing on what seems like a really transformative skill in business today, creative confidence.
That's right.
And our mission here is really to unpack this core concept. It's fundamentally a belief system, isn't it? It dictates how you approach pretty much every challenge.
Yeah, exactly. Whether you're, building a huge company or just trying to optimize a spreadsheet,
Right.
it's the starting point, really, for any kind of innovation. Creative confidence, I mean, at its heart, it's not just about being optimistic. It's more like this quiet conviction that, okay, maybe you haven't solved this problem yet, but you have the inner scaffolding, the ability to learn, iterate, and ultimately create change.
That makes sense.
It's that critical difference between saying, oh, I can't do that, and saying, okay, I haven't learned to do that yet.
And what's really interesting from the sources is how universal this is supposed to be. It's not just for people who think of themselves as artists or creatives.
Absolutely not. And you can kind of see this if you look at the origins of this whole movement, right?
Yeah.
With the Kelly brothers, David and Tom, they founded IDEO, the design firm, and Stanford's D School.
Right, IDEO, big names.
Huge. And their backgrounds, they really illustrate this perfectly, how it's like a muscle you can develop. David, he was, the quintessential unconventional type,
Yeah.
always tinkering, artistic, building these giant plywood things in the garage, apparently even modified a phone so it could only dial his girlfriend's number.
That's dedication, and maybe an early example of designing with constraints.
Could be. Meanwhile, his younger brother Tom took a much more traditional path. Buttoned up,
Okay.
liberal arts degree, then an MBA, worked as a management consultant,
Yeah.
lots of spreadsheets, financial models, very structured.
So different worlds.
Totally. He only really rediscovered the fun of coloring outside the lines, as he puts it, when he joined David in the design world.
So the message is pretty clear then for you listening. It doesn't matter what your background is, architecture, finance, teaching, whatever. The sources are saying this creative capacity, it's inside everyone.
Exactly. It's a resource, kind of like a muscle, that you can strengthen
Right.
and you probably should strengthen.
Right.
And, that universality, that's really what drove their motivation later on. This whole concept took on this like profound urgency back in 2007.
What happened?
Well, David faced a really life-altering event. He got a throat cancer diagnosis, only a 40% survival chance.
Wow, that's heavy.
Yeah. And facing that, it forced him to ask, what was I actually put on earth to do? And part of his answer became helping other people realize their creative potential while they still have the chance.
That experience really pushed this work forward, then.
It really did. Gave it urgency, pushed it into the mainstream.
Okay, so let's unpack this idea of creative confidence in action. The sources really emphasize starting with the core of design thinking, this human-centered approach. It stresses that real innovation, it doesn't start with what's technically possible or financially viable. No, it has to start with desirability, the human factors first.
Exactly. And there's an incredible case study in the materials about this involving an MRI machine designer. Really brings it to life.
Let's hear it.
Okay, so this guy, Doug Dietz, he's a veteran at GE, 24 years, an engineer. And he was, deeply proud of his technical skills. He designed this high-tech MRI system.
State of the art, presumably.
Totally.
Yeah.
He even submitted it for a big design award, the International Design Excellence Award. He thought, I nailed the engineering challenge.
Okay.
But then his whole perspective shifted. He was in the hospital one day and saw this young girl, absolutely terrified, approaching his machine, clinging to her parents.
Oh, no.
And he realized in that moment that his elegant design, well, to her, it was just monstrous, scary.
Yeah, I can imagine. Those machines are loud and confining.
Exactly. And the data really backed that up. He learned that up to 80% of pediatric patients, kids, had to be sedated just because they were too frightened to lie still.
80%, that's huge. So his brilliant machine was failing its smallest users.
Completely failing the user experience. So instead of just accepting sedation as like the only fix, Doug really embraced these human-centered design ideas.
What does she do? The tech itself must be incredibly complex and expected to change.
Right, the core tech was fixed, so he couldn't redesign the inside. He had to reframe the whole challenge. He realized he needed to redesign the experience around the machine.
Ah, the experience. Okay.
And this is where the creativity really comes in. Without touching the scanner itself, he and his team basically turned the MRI suite into what they called an adventure series.
An adventure.
Using really simple stuff, actually, colorful, inexpensive decals, narrative scripts. They turned the tunnel, the bore of the machine, into, say, the entrance to a pirate ship, or a canoe floating down a river.
That's clever.
My favorite one is the spaceship, a cylindrical spaceship. And you know those loud, rhythmic, kind of terrifying noises the MRI makes?
Yeah, the banging.
Well, in the spaceship adventure, the script reframes that noise. It tells the kids the ship is shifting into hyperdrive.
Huh. Brilliant. So the scary sound becomes part of the fun.
Exactly. It's no longer a threat. It's a necessary, even exciting part of the adventure.
And the impact. Did it work?
Oh, immediately.
Hmm?
And dramatically. The need for sedation just plummeted. Patient satisfaction scores, they went up 90%.
90%.
But the real measure, the emotional transformation,
hmm?
It's summed up by this one story. After a scan, a little six-year-old girl turned to her mom and asked, "Mommy, can we come back tomorrow?"
Wow. To an MRI. That says everything.
Doesn't it? Such a powerful example. Prioritizing empathy, that human element, it leads directly to breakthrough innovation, even in super complex fields like medical imaging.
Okay, so that's the potential, huge potential. But getting there, achieving that kind of breakthrough, it takes courage.
Yeah.
Which brings us, I guess, to the main things that stop people. The sources talk about two primary internal blocks.
Yeah, the big ones are fear and what's called the fixed mindset.
Let's tackle the fixed mindset first. This is based on Carol Dweck's work, right?
That's right, her pivotal research.
It's the belief that your skills, things like innovation, creativity, even intelligence, they're just inherent, set in stone. You've either got it or you don't.
And if you believe that, if you have that fixed mindset, you tend to avoid any situation that might expose a weakness.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to look bad.
Yeah, the sources had that striking example, the students in Hong Kong.
Oh, yeah. The ones who actively chose not to take an optional English improvement course, even though it could help their careers.
Why? Because they didn't want to risk looking bad at English now.
Exactly. They were willing to basically sabotage their future success just to avoid that momentary vulnerability.
Mm.
That's the fixed mindset in action.
So creative confidence,
yes,
is just fundamentally impossible if you're stuck there.
Pretty much. You need the prerequisite, which is the growth mindset. The belief that, okay, maybe I'm not good at this now, but I can learn, I can improve.
You could always get better.
Right.
Okay, so that's one block. Then there's the other giant one, the fear of failure.
Ah, yeah. The big one. Probably the most common innovation killer out there.
There's this sort of cultural myth, isn't there, that creative geniuses, the Edisons, the Darwins, they just don't fail. They hit home runs every time.
Total myth. Research by people like Dean Keith Simonton. Looking at these creative outliers, it shows the complete opposite. They were actually prolific when it came to failure.
So they failed more.
Way more. They didn't succeed because they had, like, a higher batting average per experiment. They succeeded because they just did more experiments.
Yeah.
More swings.
Right.
The sources kind of spill out the math of innovation. If you want more successes, you just have to be prepared to shrug off way more failures along the way.
Okay, but how do you get the courage? How do you psychologically get to the point where you can just shrug off failure? It still stinks, so, right?
It does. And the sources point towards the work of psychologist Albert Bandura. His stuff on guided mastery.
Guided mastery. Okay, what is that?
Well, he originally developed it to cure lifelong phobias. The classic example is snake phobia. Seems impossible to cure.
It sounds tough.
But the process is remarkable. It involves this carefully structured, long sequence of challenges. Each one is tailored to be just like barely within reach for the participant.
So baby steps.
Tiny, tiny baby steps.
Yeah.
It might start incredibly small.
Yeah.
Maybe just watching a video of someone else holding a snake. Then maybe looking at a snake through a one-way mirror. Uses tools like vicarious learning, seeing someone else do it safely.
Okay.
And you slowly, gradually increase the challenge, step by step, until eventually...
They can touch the snake.
They can touch the snake. And the phobia is gone, cured.
That's amazing in itself. But you said there was more to it.
Yeah, here's the really fascinating part. Bandura found this crucial side effect, overcoming that one specific lifelong phobia. It completely altered the participants' belief system about themselves, their self-efficacy.
How so?
It changed their belief about their ability to tackle challenges and change in completely unrelated parts of their lives.
Seriously? Like what?
Like people who went through this snake phobia therapy, suddenly taking up challenging hobbies, like horseback riding, or finding the confidence to become fearless public speakers, things totally unrelated to snakes.
Wow. So conquering one fear kind of bleeds over.
Exactly. You have to, as they say, touch the snake.
Yeah.
You confront that fear even in a small, manageable way, and it unlocks this transferable, empowered mindset. It proves to you that you can change.
Okay, so the mindset is unlocked. You believe you can do it. But then comes the next hurdle, which can be just as hard, right? Actually doing something.
Yes. Translating that newfound belief into sustained action. Moving past that inertia. The knowing-doing gap.
The knowing-doing gap. I like that phrase. Knowing what you should do versus actually doing it.
Exactly. Because the sources show the most devastating failure often isn't like a bad prototype or a failed experiment. It's organizational inertia. Just not acting.
Like the Kodak example.
Oh, Kodak is the classic painful example. They actually invented the first digital camera way back in 1975.
No way. I didn't know it was them.
Yep. But because they were so heavily invested in their huge profitable film business, the chemistry side, they just sat on it. They failed to act on the massive insight they already possessed.
They knew what to do, but didn't do it. Ouch.
Yeah. So the alternative, the antidote to that is the do something mindset. Just start.
And there's a great story illustrating this too, right? The founders of Pulse News.
Yeah, Akshay Kothari and Ankit Gupta. They were in this 10-week class at Stanford called Launchpad. And the goal wasn't, you know, write a perfect business plan.
What was it?
Start a real company in 10 weeks. Totally. So they basically minimized the planning and just maximized action. Focus on getting an idea tangible, fast. They built a functional prototype for their newsreader app in just 4 days.
4 days. That's moving.
Right. And their iteration method was, well, kind of genius in its simplicity. They started really lo-fi, using post-it notes to simulate the user interface.
Okay.
Then they moved to software mock-ups on a brand new iPad. And to get feedback, no fancy focus groups. They just went to a cafe in Palo Alto, handed the iPad to strangers.
Just watch.
And just watched. In silence, they saw where people got stuck, what they tapped on instinctively. They made hundreds of tiny tweaks, small iterations, every single day based on that direct observation.
Wow, that's rapid learning.
Incredibly rapid. And that relentless fast cycle action, it paid off big time. Pulse News got featured by Steve Jobs himself at a Big Apple event.
Huge boost.
Massive. It got downloaded by 20 million people. And eventually, it was acquired for around $90 million.
$90 million from a 10-week class project based on rapid action.
Yeah. And Ankit, one of the founders, said something like, creativity isn't about waiting for the one perfect idea. It's about trying and failing at 100 other things first to find the best one.
Which really reinforces that idea about quantity leading to quality, especially early on.
Exactly. There's that famous story, maybe you've heard it, about the ceramics instructor.
Vaguely familiar. Remind me.
Okay, so this instructor splits the class into two groups. Tells one group, you'll be graded solely on the quality of a single perfect pot you produce all semester.
Okay, focus on perfection.
Right. Tells the other group, you'll be graded purely on quantity, just the total weight, the pounds of pottery you produce. Doesn't matter how good it is.
Interesting experiment. So what happened?
Well, predictably, all the best quality pots, the most beautiful, well-crafted pieces, they came from the quantity group.
The quantity group. Why?
Because the quality group spent most of their time just thinking, theorizing, worrying about perfection. They barely made anything.
Analysis paralysis.
Totally. Whereas the quantity group, they were just churning out pots, making mistakes, learning from them, trying again, getting that immediate hands-on feedback, refining their technique through sheer volume.
So failure sucks.
Absolutely.
But it instructs better than just thinking about success.
Way better. Yeah. Okay, so once you embrace action, how do you keep finding inspiration? How do you cultivate that spark day to day? The sources offer some practical strategies.
Good, let's hear them.
One key technique is to try and think like a traveler.
Think like a traveler. What does that mean? Like, take more vacations.
Huh. Not quite. It means trying to look at your familiar surroundings, your everyday routines, with a beginner's mind. Like you're seeing it for the first time.
Oh, okay. Noticing things you usually filter out.
Exactly. Forcing yourself to see the details that habit normally just smooths over. There's an example with Tom Kelly and another IDEO person, Kara. They were in Shinjuku Station in Tokyo, super busy place.
Right.
And they noticed this young woman wearing brightly colored sneakers.
But here's the thing. One was turquoise and the other was hot pink.
Mismatched sneakers. Okay, quirky.
Yeah, most people would just dismiss it, right? An oddity, maybe a fashion statement, maybe she got dressed in the dark.
Probably.
But they paused. They used that traveler's mindset and they thought, wait a minute, is there actually a market for deliberately mismatched footwear?
Huh. Interesting question.
And that tiny observation, that departure from the norm, It quickly connected them to the fact that little mismatched socks, deliberately mismatched socks, were already a successful product.
Ah, so there was a precedent.
Exactly. It confirmed the market for playful mismatching was already there, just waiting for someone to apply it to shoes. You need that open, curious traveler's mind to spot those kinds of opportunities.
Okay, think like a traveler. Got it. What else?
A second really crucial strategy is to constantly ask why and reframe the challenge you're working on.
Ask why? Like a five-year-old. Kinda. We often just accept the initial problem statement as it's given to us. But digging deeper, asking why repeatedly, it often leads you to the real problem and therefore to much better solutions.
Okay, give me an example.
Right. Take the surgical tool redesign example from the sources. Doctors were complaining about hand fatigue using a particular tool. So the initial question the design team got was, how can we make this tool lighter? Seems logical.
Yeah, less weight, less fatigue. Makes sense.
But when the team started asking why does the weight cause fatigue? Is it just the weight? They realized the core issue wasn't necessarily the absolute grams. It was more about the balance, the strain, how it felt in the hand during long procedures.
Ah, so it wasn't just about lightness.
Exactly. So they reframed the challenge. Instead of how to make it lighter, they asked, how might we make the surgical tool more comfortable in the hand?
That's a different question entirely.
It's a monumental shift. And that reframing led them to a solution that involved simply shifting the tool's center of gravity. Made it feel much better balanced.
And did it end up lighter?
Actually, no. The final tool was technically a few grams heavier, but the surgeons loved it because it felt so much more comfortable.
Yeah.
The strain was gone.
Wow. So they solved the real problem, the desirability problem, even by slightly ignoring the initial make it lighter constraint.
Precisely. That's the power of reframing.
Okay, so we have the mindset, the action, the strategies. How does this all tie into, like, overall career happiness, finding work you love?
Yeah, that's really the ultimate goal, isn't it? When you combine creative confidence with these kinds of strategies, it's not just about business success, it's about professional fulfillment.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings us back to that model from Jim Collins' three overlapping circles, finding your sweet spot.
Right, the three circles, what are they again?
It's the intersection of, one, what are you really good at, your skills, two, what will people actually pay you to do? The market reality.
Oh, okay.
And three, this is the crucial one. What were you sort of born to do? What activities give you that feeling of flow where you're so absorbed, time just disappears?
Finding that intersection, that's the dream, I guess.
That's the sweet spot where creative confidence meets genuine, sustainable joy in your work.
Is there an example of someone finding that?
Yeah, there's the story of Scott Woody. He was a biophysics PhD candidate, super smart, technically excellent.
Sounds promising.
But he felt like a cog in the machine, like a drone in the lab. He lacked that sense of purpose, that flow. He took a creative class, actually, something called Creative Gym, just to try and shake things up.
And did it work?
It did more than that. The boost in self-efficacy, in creative confidence, it gave him the courage to make a massive pivot. He quit his PhD program.
Whoa. That's a huge decision, especially in academia.
Huge. And apparently his mother was not happy about it initially. Deeply disapproved.
Yeah, imagine.
But he used that newfound confidence to start his own company, a venture-backed recruiting startup called Foundry Hiring. He realized that while he was good at science research, what he felt born to do was connect people, build something, solve problems in that recruiting space.
And the startup was successful.
Successful. And more importantly, he was fulfilled. His mother eventually came around, saw how much happier he was. He found his sweet spot.
That's a great story. So the big takeaway here for you listening seems to be creative confidence isn't something you just think about or plan for. You gain it through action.
Exactly. It's an accumulation of small steps, like overcoming that snake phobia, remember? Small, manageable actions build that belief.
Right. And you don't need a massive budget or, you know, 6 months blocked out on your calendar to start. Constraints can actually help.
They absolutely can. Like that VP at Fidelity mentioned in the sources, he challenged his team to finish a project that was planned for 6 months in one day.
One day. That's impossible.
Well, he didn't expect a perfect finished product. He expected rapid iteration, intense learning, breaking through assumptions, and that's exactly what he got. The constraint forced creativity.
So the advice is, embrace continuous learning, keep experimenting, even tiny things.
Especially tiny things, low-risk steps. Maybe next time you're in a meeting, try adding a quick sketch to the whiteboard to explain your idea visually. Don't worry if it's not perfect.
Or try that yes and technique from improv.
Yeah. Go through a whole day consciously trying to build on people's ideas with yes and instead of your default no because or but. See what happens.
Even changing how you talk to your kids, like the example given. Instead of, did you have a good day? Ask something more specific, more creative.
Like if you were going to tell grandma about your latest school project, how would you describe it?
Right. It prompts storytelling, different thinking. These tiny shifts add up.
It's all about being an active agent then, in your own life, in your organization,
right.
Turning those challenges into chances to grow.
That's the core of it.
Okay, so we'll leave you with this final thought, something often cited in the source material we looked at. If you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own.
I love that. It's a call to action.
It really is. Go take action. Make your own dent in the universe.